Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.
The Guardian.
We Brits are obsessed with the weather.
I don't think I could go one day without mentioning the weather, especially if it's sunny.
And it feels like we're never quite happy. It's either too hot, too cold, too muggy, too windy. The list goes on.
But we're always happier when we're able to plan ahead for the weather, whether that means wearing an extra layer on leaving the house for that day or knowing what to pack for a holiday. Unfortunately, getting the most accurate forecast isn't that simple.
So the Cray computer in itself has about a million lines of computer coding. And for this to work, the computer runs 16 trillion calculations per second.
Even with trillions of calculations per second, no one has managed to forecast with 100% accuracy. But there are companies out there which say they can provide the most precise forecast over any other institution with a combination of traditional forecasting methods and new technology.
They're trying to basically tap into the many, many devices around the world, so smartphones, Internet of Things devices, and using signals from those to get a more accurate forecast. The promise is basically to turn everything into a weather sensor.
I'm Jordan Erica Weber.
And I'm Greya Jackson.
And this week, Chips with Everything is teaming up with our sister podcast, Science Weekly, to take a look at the history of weather forecasting.
And its potential future, which may require the likes of you and I to hand over a bunch of data in return for the perfect weather forecast.
This is Science with Everything.
Hello.
Hi, Claire.
Hello.
Hi, it's Greya from The Guardian.
Hi, Greya. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. How about yourself?
Yeah, good.
This is Claire Nasir. She's a meteorologist at the Met Office, which is perfect because the guy who invented weather forecasting also founded the Met Office. His name was Admiral Robert Fitzroy, and Claire says he was driven by the massive loss of life at sea. Between 1855 and 1860, over 7,000 people perished at sea.
Lots of ships were lost during this time, and it was down to a few brave, hearty souls who thought, this can't just be coincidence, it can't be just an issue of fate. There has to be something to do with weather patterns where we can perhaps prevent people from dying or crashing into the rocks because of storms. And one particular person that comes to mind is Admiral Robert Fitzroy. And he really was the forefather when it comes to weather forecasting. He was actually more well remembered, to be honest, in the day as Charles Darwin's captain on the HMS Beagle.
Ah, yes, I knew I'd heard the name before and it was bugging me.
That's right, yes.
Back then, sailors relied on experience. Gathering clouds might mean a storm is a-coming. And the Victorians also relied on animals for forecasting.
Wait, animals?
Yeah, there's not much information out there on this, but take a look at this picture.
This guy looks like, so is he wearing like a nightcap? Well, he's holding a jar, like a jam jar, with a frog inside the jar and what appears to be a ladder. Is the ladder for the frog?
The ladder is for the frog, yeah. So basically the frog would climb the ladder if the weather was good, and when conditions were going to be bad, supposedly, it would climb back down the ladder and into the water to weather out the worst of the storm.
That's a hell of a thermometer, isn't it? Just imagine everyone with jars in their windowsills with frogs in them. I actually really frogs used to be my favourite animal, but I replaced them with squids because intelligence. But honestly, this makes frogs seem pretty smart.
I don't know how to respond.
That's fine,
that.
Don't.
Animal intelligence aside, Jordan, the real big thing that came in and changed and turned this all around was the telegraph. It meant that Admiral Robert Fitzroy could gather weather in real time and then dispatch that information to ports. So if a gale was detected in, say, the Isle of Man and it was heading east, he could alert the ports in Liverpool to it. And then the port could raise the alarm by raising a flag or something.
Obviously, with a little bit of technology and being able to extend that information further afield, we were able to say, yes, there's something happening here and that could happen to you, say, down the line.
And how accurate was that, that it's happening here and therefore it might blow over to you kind of prediction?
Well, I think with the electric telegraph, it was more such a bewildering technology. It took a long time for people to really understand what it was. But initially, it did help. And that really caught on, really, particularly in the UK. And before long, we saw our first weather forecast in a newspaper, and that was in 1861. That was the Times. So, yes, it really caught on. Not always correct, and a lot of time it wasn't, but certainly I think once the British people really got an understanding of what could be done with weather forecasting, a lot of other people caught on. And, it's our favourite subject, isn't it, to be honest, Greya? Everybody wants to talk about it. And then I think a lot of things took a long time to settle down about how do we measure, say, temperature, but also things like pressure. It wasn't really until the mid-1860s that another scientist called Alexandra Buchan joined the dots of pressure, and that pressure became an isobars, and then we understood that there were discrete areas where the pressure would drop, the pressure would rise, and associated weather with that, hence cold fronts, warm fronts, high pressure, low pressure. So it was a very slow process during the late 1800s into the 1900s, but then obviously two world wars broke out, and during that time, technology not only escalated, communications not only escalated, but it was much more vital that we understood where we were going with the weather forecast.
So forecasting very much relied on making an observation, making some kind of back of the envelope calculations, and then communicating a prediction.
Yeah, Fitzroy calculated them by hand with very little data, so you can imagine how forecasts would go awry. The next big step in making better predictions, though, was modelling. Now, when I asked Claire about this, I was expecting her to talk about supercomputers. But actually, the forefathers of computer modelling imagined how to do this with people as computers.
So there was an amazing scientist called Lewis Fry Richardson, and he visualised many, many people in a room doing hundreds of calculations, which in turn would interpret how the atmosphere would change over, say, 24 hours or so. There was a concept there, there was an understanding there, and a desperation for the technology to move on so we could really understand and model the atmosphere in such a way that it would take less time to forecast the weather before the weather actually happened. So say in the 1950s, it would take a day to compile a day's forecast.
Wow. And how many people would be doing that?
Well, hundreds of people. And that's the thing is, you know, the Met Office was established well before that, and it's grown and grown. Nowadays, I work in a fantastic environment with thousands of scientists and forecasters and observers, all passionate about the weather, and we're all sharing our data elsewhere. But this is something which has taken time.
But today, we do rely on computers.
And it's lucky we do, because every day, the Met Office receives around 500,000 observations of temperature, humidity, and many other atmospheric variables.
There's a huge amount of observation data which is out there. My first job I ever did in the Met Office was observe the clouds. So that's one form of observation. Another form of observation is what's happening perhaps in the sky when pilots are flying. They're picking up information. Shipping lanes are picking up information. We have something called radiosondes or weather balloons, which we release every day, which push up into the upper atmosphere, and they take readings of temperature, humidity, wind speed, etc., which is vital data that then we can analyse, not only as forecasters, but also they get put into the computer models. So observations take many forms. So yes, all that information gets added to the initial conditions on a computer model.
Okay, and talk me through this computer model. Is it just sort of running through simulations of what could happen and pick the most likely? What's it doing?
Well, the computer model is based on a set of equations which tries to model the atmosphere. They're called the primitive equations, and they are nonlinear, which means nothing really goes in a straight line, which, as we know, doesn't. But it really sort of tries to approximate a global atmospheric flow. And so we've got different aspects to that. We've got the momentum, we've got the thermal energy, we've got the pressure rises and falls. We've got to take into consideration gravity, friction. So all these forces get pushed into these equations, and then we run these computer models, adding all this data to these equations, and out pops a solution at the other end. But obviously it's not as simple as that.
I was going to say, the equations you're talking about, are they the same equations that people would have been doing in the 50s that you described? These hundreds of people doing these equations, I imagine them in a back room, busy, 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 somehow like a stock exchange. I don't know why that imagery comes to mind.
It doesn't.
But is that the kind of thing that these supercomputers are doing?
On one level, it is, and it's incredible, really, because that's how we used to do it. And that's the most amazing thing about what computers do nowadays. Here at the Met Office, we use supercomputers. So the Cray computer is one of 20 most powerful computers in the world, and I think our weather computer is the most powerful weather computer in the world. And let me give you some big numbers here, because it's absolutely immense. They look like massive TARDISes, you know, I don't know if that's the plural TARDIS, but you can imagine Doctor Who dipping in and out of one and then the other. So the Cray computer in itself has about 1 million lines of computer coding. And for this to work, the computer runs 16 trillion calculations per second, or 16 petaflops. And let me put that in perspective. That's 2 million calculations for every man, woman, child on this planet every second.
That is astonishing. Just talk me through refining. I know refining is a really important element of tweaking these models.
Every day we see the output of computer models. Here at the Met Office, there's a host of weather forecasters and scientists who are analysing this data. But we do know where there are weaknesses in the model. So it's up to the expertise of the chief forecaster and his team to see where the model is weak and then add value and tweak, refine those computer models, or then add that information back into the computer and run it again. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like there's a human and computer sort of partnership going on here, and both play a very important role when it comes to weather forecasting.
How accurate are our weather forecasts today? I read in the paper that only recently that, you know, we were supposed to have some Spanish tunnel of wind and that for May, and we're going to have gloriously hot weather, but that doesn't seem to have materialised. So how accurate is our weather forecast, and how often do we get it wrong?
It's something in the 90% for temperature forecast, 24-hour and 3-day forecast. That's how good it is. And then it slips down the further away we get from day one. So it is very, very good. And the accuracy keeps improving, but there will always be days where we get it wrong.
Now, I really want to know how we can make a better prediction of the weather.
But 90% accuracy is pretty good.
Yeah, there's still room for improvement, though. And also that 90% refers to the temperature predictions. So 92% of their next day forecasts are accurate to within 2 degrees centigrade. But then their rain predictions for the next day are only right about 75% of the time.
After the break, we'll look at one startup that is taking the idea of gathering more data and using it to, as they say, revolutionise weather forecasting.
We'll be back after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Welcome back to Science with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber.
And I'm Greg Jackson. Before the break, we took a trip down memory lane to look at the history of weather forecasting. Meteorologist Claire Nazir told us how the Met Office predicts the weather with three key steps. First, through observing and collecting vast amounts of information about the climate right now. Secondly, modelling, putting those data points through a computer model to create a forecast. And thirdly, refining. Meteorologists tweak the model's predictions based on their own knowledge and expertise.
Claire explained that the technology used in forecasting is getting better, but some of her colleagues have been quoted in the past as saying that we will never be able to reach 100% accuracy.
But there are some who suspect we can still do better.
Exactly. A weather tech startup in Boston called Climacell claims to have figured out how to use various new technologies to create a forecasting system with fewer errors. We did invite someone from the company to come on the show, but unfortunately they didn't have time. They did, however, answer our questions with some links to press releases and blog posts. But I was also interested to hear from a journalist who's written about WeatherTech in the past.
My name's Charlotte G, and I'm a reporter for MIT Technology Review.
I started by asking Charlotte to tell me a bit more about Climacell.
So Climacell was founded in 2015, so they're fairly recent, based in Boston. And they basically claim that they found a way to make weather forecasting much, much more accurate. So it's currently mainly based on satellite data and other sort of sensor data. And they're trying to basically tap into the many, many devices around the world, so smartphones, Internet of Things devices, and using signals from those to get a more accurate forecast. However, precisely how they're doing that is still a little bit unclear, but the promise is basically to turn everything into a weather sensor. That's the way that they put it.
So it's always fun when companies coin terms, you know, when they come up with catchy new phrases, and Climacell is no different. They've trademarked the term micro weather. So What is micro weather?
So that would basically be a weather forecast down to a very, very precise degree. So normally weather forecasts can be many, many meters, hundreds of meters, maybe even miles out. Whereas this is talking about getting it right down to this sort of precise street level, for example. That is what they're promising.
In May, Climacell launched CBAM, which stands for Climacell's Bespoke Atmospheric Model, or as they like to call it, Climacell Badass Model.
Badass.
Yeah, I know. But putting the name aside, they say their technology is revolutionary.
It's all about the precision, from my understanding. It's all about getting a forecast that is very exact. So that would be quite useful for airlines, for example, for football matches or other sports matches. There's seriously big business in this area because it's just worth a lot of money if you can actually produce that. But one caveat I'd add is that this is an area that a lot of startups have actually been trying to crack before. And whether or not they can do it, I would inject a little bit of skepticism personally. I think it sounds very exciting. It does sound promising. But until we really get the ability to drill into precisely how they're doing it, I would just reserve a bit of judgment.
I get where Charlotte is coming from here. We asked Climacell exactly how the technology works, and after reading through the various press releases and blog posts, I'm still not sure. Basically, they've said they're using infrastructure that is already in existence. So, wireless signals that power cell phones and media communications, millions of connected vehicles reporting parameters such as temperature, wiper status, and fog lights, satellite-to-ground microwave signals, street cameras which will use machine learning to analyze images and, for example, infer precipitation conditions, Internet of Things devices, and good old-fashioned airplanes and drones, which transmit wind, humidity, and temperature data.
It sounds like a lot of these won't physically be measuring the weather, though, like the humidity or temperature. They're inferring what it might be like.
Right, and Charlotte explained that they'll have to go through all of this data to turn it into something useful.
I think the way to think of it is that they're not going to be using just signals from that. They're going to be using those as a proxy for something else, if you see what I mean. So they're going to be kind of triangulating the data. I imagine, I should really add that as a caveat, I don't have that deep insight into precisely how their business is working. But they're not just going to be taking all that raw data and then putting that back out as a weather forecast.
So with all their promises to create more accurate forecasts, did they provide a percentage that we could compare to the Met Office's 90-odd percent accuracy?
Not that I could see. But they argue that one of the problems with traditional weather forecasting is that it isn't equal. In some parts of the world, lack of infrastructure means that people don't have access to forecasts that others in more developed areas might get.
Hang on, if the idea is that we can democratize weather forecasting, so predictions for everyone, even in remote areas, how can those areas possibly have access to the millions of connected cars or smartphones or drones or street cameras?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. Climacell says it's turning existing infrastructure into weather sensors. So if it isn't there in the first place, I don't see how it can be used by the company. Charlotte did, however, make an interesting point about how they might get data from wireless signals.
Everywhere in the world, and definitely in the developing world as well, you will still get smartphones. So I could, if they're using sort of smartphones more widely as a proxy for forecasting weather, then I can see how that actually could be viable. But yeah, certainly I can't really see there being sort of tons of people driving around very high-tech driverless cars in, you know, different remote parts of the world. But yeah, I definitely, in terms of people using smartphones and stuff like that, that kind of does make sense.
Right, but if Climacell is going to use things like smartphones, Internet of Things devices, cars, this is obviously going to ring alarm bells for people with regards to privacy. And now when we asked Climacell about this, they sent us to a blog post in which they've written in capital letters, "We never get exposed to any private data, full stop, ever." And they also say that they're compliant with GDPR and they've been cleared by regulators in multiple countries to handle these kinds of data. So does that mean I should stop worrying?
Even if you're not looking for personally identifiable information, you could potentially still find it if you're looking at a volume of data that large. So I think it is a risk, definitely.
Now, the reason I'm talking to you about this in particular is because you wrote an article back in January about how the city of Los Angeles is suing the Weather Channel app, accusing it of collecting, sharing and selling users' location data without their consent. So in this particular instance, what data have they been accused of selling and who were they supposedly selling it to?
Location data, email addresses, IMEI identification numbers, which basically ties you to your exact mobile phone, to data brokers. So this is kind of a shady world of middlemen who buy and sell people's data. So in honesty, we don't really know who. Anyone who wants to buy it, basically.
I should point out that the company behind the Weather Channel app disputes this allegation and, when asked, said it has always been transparent in its use of location data.
So we don't know who was supposedly buying the data in this particular case, but why would data from a weather app be useful to anyone?
Generally speaking, probably advertisers, people who want to know where what the locations are that people tend to gather at. So they want to look at sort of how people are moving and the patterns. And so then that way they can say, right, well, we should be putting these adverts in this location because these people are most likely to see it. I'm kind of massively simplifying it, but that's basically the logic. It's so people can sell stuff to you.
Obviously, we all want better weather forecasts. And just to say that Climacell haven't been accused of using data in any negative way. But obviously, I'd still want to be a bit careful about where my data goes.
Yeah, and as someone who likes to dress for the weather, I don't think I could stop using weather apps altogether. So Charlotte gave us some tips on how to better protect our data.
I think the best way forward is actually to go onto a website to search the weather forecast and type in your address manually, which takes longer, but it means that they're not using your GPS tracker. The simple answer is this is so symptomatic of the broader trade-off between convenience and privacy, in that, you know, if you are using something like that that's really easy and it's one click, generally speaking, that's because you've given it access to all of your all of your different other apps. So, yeah.
Lastly, one of our colleagues suggested that weather apps should go in the direction of traffic apps, or some traffic apps, where users can send in updates of high traffic spots or accidents. Do you think there's a future in weather forecasting for user-generated content like this, and would it work?
I'm certain that people are going to be working on that already. I'll tell you what, a really interesting area where that's being tried in terms of user-generated content is actually in terms of natural disasters. And that's something that is being worked on and developed right now, where people can say, like, this is the level of earthquake that I've experienced, or this is sort of, if there's been a tsunami or something like that, people can report how serious it was. They can take photos of the damage, they can share them. So yeah, definitely there is something to be said for that. I think for weather specifically though, it's actually not necessarily as reliable as using the official sources. So for now, although it's a nice idea, I'd probably stick with the Met Office over Steve from Crawley.
Okay, noted. Since you've got deep into weather tech for this, do you have any predictions for the upcoming summer in London? Should I get my shorts out?
Yeah, it's going to be absolutely glorious. I mean, this is based on no real expertise, but just a hunch. It's going to be great.
Now, with some of the tech we discuss on this podcast, there are reasonable arguments to suggest that if we want to avoid potential risks to our privacy, then we could just go without. So people often say that about social media, right? Stop complaining, just stop using it. But I feel like weather forecasting is the kind of thing that is pretty crucial and will only become more so given the climate crisis. I will definitely continue to use weather apps and hope that they become more accurate. But I will also follow Charlotte's advice and only ever type in my location manually from now on.
Given what Charlotte said about trusting the Met Office, I should have asked our very own Met Office guest, Claire, about whether we're going to get a sunny summer or not. I was really consumed with why May has been so cold that I forgot to ask.
It has been pretty cold, hasn't it?
Yeah, especially if you compare it to last May, when I seem to remember the temperatures were, 27 degrees? Do you remember the London Marathon? People were keeling over because it was so hot. That's how hot it was, and it's just been rubbish this May by comparison.
Not that we want to wish for London Marathon runners to keel over.
No, that's a good point. I just like to bathe in that glorious sunshine.
I know, yeah.
The only thing I will add is just to say thank you to our guests. They were Claire Nazir and Charlotte G.
We really enjoy teaming up to produce Science with Everything, so let us know if there are stories out there that we should be collaborating on. You can send us an email to either chipspodcast@theguardian.com or scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Jordan Erica Weber.
And I'm Grey Jackson.
Until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.